Hi there and welcome. I'm Tracy Zimiska and welcome to the latest edition of my yoga podcast, where I talk to different yoga teachers from around the world to hear their story, what got them to the mat, what keeps them there, and why they teach, and also a little information and guidance for people new to yoga or people who just want to try it out and not sure where to start. Thanks for joining us, and I hope you enjoy the latest edition of my podcast. Welcome back, everyone. This is Tracy Zimiska, and I'm here with another podcast. And I'm here with today with my friend Sava Pappos from Perth, Australia. So welcome, Sava.
Thanks, Tracy. Hi, it's great to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. I want to make sure that we don't forget to talk about your travels, because you travel quite a bit, and I'd like to hear about some of that, too, from, you know, who you are and stuff. But first, I always like to start off with how you discovered yoga, why did you keep doing it, and sort of how you did your teacher training journey, like what made you want to be a teacher. And
wow, there's a lot in there already, isn't
there? Yeah.
So I guess I started yoga a long time ago, I guess about 20 years ago now. It was mid to late 90s, and I think it was a little different here in Australia compared to how it was in the United States. You know, I think it was quite popular over there by that stage, but here in Australia, most of all in the city I live in, which is quite a remote city on the west coast of Australia, in Perth, it wasn't really heard of. Yoga wasn't anything that it was popular or people did. It was kind of really kind of underground, and it existed kind of in church halls or small rented spaces. There was nothing like the yoga studio kind of saturation that we experience now throughout many cities. I was working in quite a stressful, in a very, very stressful environment, and I wasn't coping well. I needed some tools to help me find stability and grounding and deal with stress, I guess, in my life. And randomly I was communicating with somebody who owned a business next to mine who mentioned she was doing some training in the United States to train yoga. And that's the first time I heard of this thing called yoga. And from then, you know, something opens your eyes to something, then you hear about it from everywhere. So then I started hearing random snippets from different kind of sources, interesting people that I liked and communicated well with, talking about this thing called yoga. And then from an avenue that I completely didn't expect it at all, my sister mentioned that she was practicing it in a church hall. I went with her one day, and I rarely remember the first time I did anything, but for this first practice of yoga, it's still vivid in my memory, and how I received it and how I left that space was completely elated and completely rejuvenated and feeling so refreshed. And I remember the smile on my face as I walked out. I went on my own, and it was a lot of older people, and it was a very mild kind of hatha kind of, not even a flow. I don't think we had flow back then either. It was just hold this pose. Hold this pose, hold this pose. But I remember the feeling it gave me. So that was my discovery of yoga. So from that time, I invested in it more and more, because that sensation was something that I wasn't getting from anywhere, you know. And I started practicing once a week. I then moved to twice a week on a regular basis, on a weekly basis. And, you know, yoga was very cheap then. It was a $4 membership, and it was $2 per class.
Oh my.
so again, very well, this was in Perth as well. So again, very different to the local landscape of yoga practice. It's a little bit more costly, but I don't actually consider yoga expensive at all. I think it's very cheap for what it gives us. So then, I started practicing more, and then I found a studio after a long time. Started practicing in a studio which was more Iyengar focus, and I stayed with that studio for around 5 years. I then toyed with Ashtanga for a little while, which didn't quite suit me back then. This was probably early 2000s at this stage. So I went back to an Iyengar and Hatha style and committed to a daily practice. So by daily meaning six times a week. And sometimes I'd get into the studio twice, maybe for a more gentle flow for the second practice. Yeah, I invested more and more into it, and eventually I went back to the Ashtanga method, which I still practice. So I've been practicing Ashtanga for maybe nearing 10 years, I guess, and I completely love it. It's my chosen style of practice, and I wasn't even thinking about teaching, but my teacher, after a couple of years of practice, approached me to take his teacher training. So that just kind of opened a new kind of opportunity and exploration as well for me of the practice. I didn't imagine myself ever as a yoga teacher. and I think that's a lot of us, right? You know, we just kind of take this additional learning and additional journey just to expand our appreciation of this beautiful method. And that's all I was doing, you know. I was like, just give me more of this thing, you know. I just love it. So I took a two-year – my teacher training started with me just watching my teacher. It was a very, very slow process. I took 3 years to kind of go through my initial teacher training with him. And, yeah, I guess since then, towards the end of it, I started – teaching, which was scary, very, very scary. And yeah, I've stayed with teaching ever since, you know. And, you know, predominantly though, I mean, my experience of yoga is teaching as well, you know, it gives me so much. You know, it might be a selfish thing, but although we direct and guide people through the practice, it enriches me just as much as I think it enriches other people. So my practice and my teaching is to keep me kind of, you know, those elements that drove me to yoga in the first place, keep me grounded and keep me coping with stresses in life and to keep me focused and on track, I think. So yeah, teaching yoga has been a fantastic experience for me, just as the practice of yoga itself has been.
That's awesome. It's amazing how it changes our lives, right?
Oh, my God, completely. You know, I remember when I first started, I had to slot yoga in, practicing wherever it would work best for me. But now everything else slots in around yoga. You know, I'm sure you're the same. Like, we have to practice, and then we fit other things in, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Do you do yoga now full time? I can't remember. Are you teaching full time? What do you do?
So I was working full time up until this time last year. So July 2015, wasn't it? Last year, yeah. and I finished my full-time job there. I was working for a symphony orchestra, working on managing their database and their sales and their online processes.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
So it was it was great, but it was, again, it was really, really stressful, and there were so many situations where I was kind of asked to do things which didn't kind of sit with me as a person. You know, it was a very corporate environment, and also the work, working full time and beyond hours, as a lot of us do when we work full time, takes up all of your time and energy, and it was taking away from my yoga practice, and that's something that didn't sit well with me at all, because my yoga practice was so important to me, as I've mentioned. So I knew I needed to make changes to allow myself to practice more, and so I had to sacrifice work. I sacrificed work last year in July, and I came across to the United States and did a training over there. I think that's where I actually met you, at that first training in
Napa, I think so too.
Yeah. And then I stayed on. I've got some good friends over there. I stayed on for another few months and came back. And, you know, teaching just happened. I didn't know what I was going to do when I got back, but teaching full-time just happened. I mean, as a male teacher, as a male yogi, we're kind of rare now.
Yeah.
So I get approached a lot for a male presence in studios which are have only female teachers. So yeah, it just happened that I got offered more and more classes, and now yes, I do. It's my full-time job, if you want to call it a job. I don't call it a job. I consider it fun. Everything I do is fun now. So yeah, it's awesome. It's my livelihood as well as my passion as well. So yeah, it's awesome for me right now.
Yeah, I was transitioning around the same time that you are, and so it's been about a year now that I've been doing
it,
and I probably work more than I did technically, like if you were to count up all my hours that I spend doing social media stuff and newsletters and you know, the podcast and planning classes and all that jazz, but it certainly doesn't feel that way.
It doesn't feel that way
because you love it.
Exactly. It's something that you really, really love, and you want to invest more and more time into it, rather than the other way when you're working in a corporate or some sort of a full-time environment.
Yeah, exactly. I wanted to tell you before I forget, the last time when I saw you this past May, I was asking you about kangaroos. And and I felt so stupid asking you. I was like, oh gosh, it's like probably the biggest touristy thing I could think of to talk about.
No way.
That or like Vegemite, you know, like those are the two things that people in America know about Australia. But anyways, I was looking through, and I don't know if it was on yours or if it was on hers, but I saw when Catherine Budig was there last, that you guys had a kangaroo sighting, and they were all excited. And I remember being like, thinking to myself, I am vindicated.
They were, I mean, Catherine came over here to take a series of workshops over a weekend. And she had some workshops here in Perth. Well, she was arranging in Sydney, and I've been trying to, I mean, I've known Catherine for a little while. I've been trying to get her here to the west coast of Australia, but it's that really extra little bit of travel, which is exhausting coming from the United States. I know that kind of travel is huge, particularly on the west, from the west coast of Australia. It's kind of the furthest spot to get to from the United States. So anyway, it eventually worked out that Catherine was coming to Sydney and came over for the extra weekend in Perth. But so, you know, in the city, as in any cities, I always ask people in the United States, would there be a bear in these woods? Would there be? So I have the same thing. Or, you know, while we're working in these urban kind of environments and you see a little bit of shrub, would there be a bear in there? Or, you know, for you guys, are there kangaroos in there? So not really in the city, but we went to this beautiful part of the West Coast called Margaret River. I don't know if it's... people may know it for the fact that it's a wine region, similar to Napa in California, I guess, and they make some really delicious wines. But it's also a beautiful, beautiful spot. It's about a 3.5-hour drive south of the city of Perth, which is the capital city here on the west coast. And yeah, so we were on a mission to find, well, there were three people from the United States, well, Catherine and two others, and they were on a huge mission to see a kangaroo. So myself and the other Australian were asking every local, where can we find kangaroos? Where are all the kangaroos? Tell us where the kangaroos are. So everybody kept directing us to this one street, which is weird. And we're like, we were both skeptical, me and my friend from Perth, thinking, why would they all be on the one street? Anyway, we went to this street and there were hundreds and hundreds of kangaroos. And,
you're kidding!
Like hundreds of them just standing around eating or lying down on the grass, and they were ecstatic. So yes, we got the kangaroo sighting. So if you come to Australia, I'll take you to that street.
Okay. I love that.
Yeah.
I've seen kangaroos at the zoo, but I'd like to be able to just be like, oh, I really did envision.
In the wild.
You know? Totally, yeah, totally. Like you're just driving down the road in Australia and, oh, there's kangaroo.
Yeah. I mean, they are a fascinating creature, the way they hop along, and some of them are huge, you know, and scary, you know. They're very, very muscular, the big red kangaroos. When they stand up, they'd be taller than us as humans, you know, and they puff their chest out and can be aggressive. So they're kind of creatures that you don't want to get too close to, but they're little kind of smaller kangaroos I mean, they're, you know, like a lot of animals, more scared of us than
Right.
than we are of them.
Yeah. Well, and it's true, though. I mean, you do get acclimated to things. I remember when we were in Arizona, people were talking about the coyotes, and there are a lot of coyotes near where I live. And so I've seen them and I've been close to them. As long as they're afraid of you, you're okay. Like if we get to the point where we're like feeding coyotes, then we're going to have a problem. But as long as they still see us as something that to be afraid of, they're not harmful, really. I mean, if they're rabid, like any animal, they will attack you. But generally speaking, they're just going to walk away from you and be wary of you. And they can be quite beautiful, and they're singing that they do. They sing in the round, and it's just the most beautiful sound to listen to them. So, but I remember people sort of freaking out, like, "Oh my gosh, I saw a coyote!" I'm like, "So it's just a coyote."
Yeah, I remember you saying that. I did see one over there in Arizona, and I was following it. I was walking along the road following it, just kind of, it was aware of me looking back and forward, but it seemed to just kind of be doing its own thing. It was beautiful. It was a beautiful little thing to see.
You know what else is beautiful is fox. They're beautiful too. They're just these really beautiful animals. And but where I've lived, and even where I lived before, I live now, it's not like in a city, but it's an inner ring suburb, so it's more urban. And the houses are closer together, and I was only like 12 miles from downtown Cleveland. But we still have a ton of park space. So in my old house, before I moved down into Ak, I had possums, I had owls, we had
Oh, how
hawks,
beautiful.
woodpeckers. There was a park not far from where I lived that had bald eagles, so every once in a while an eagle would fly
You're
over.
kidding.
And no, so I mean, we had all these different, and then of course the regular things, squirrels and chipmunks, and we had the coyotes and turtles. I
Skunks.
mean, yes, skunks, lots of skunks.
We don't have them here. I'm fascinated by them.
I had a friend when I was in grad school that had a pet skunk, and she was adorable and like the sweetest little thing, and she was like a cat. I mean, she would just kind of run around, and she'd want to snuggle, and she'd chase after like little balls of yarn and stuff. She was really cute.
I saw like a Pepe Le Pew, that cartoon. Who was in love with the cat? I don't know if you remember it, a Warner Brothers cartoon. Might be showing my age a bit now.
Yes. And I think, do you remember Flower from Bambi? Flower was
Oh,
a skunk.
no. Oh, no, I don't.
Flower was a skunk, and I think my friend named his skunk Flower.
Oh,
So
right.
she was
Oh,
like this
sweet.
little, but their fur is actually really soft.
Right.
It's just as like soft and fluffy as it looks. Sometimes you have animals where their fur is not what it seems, but theirs is like soft and fluffy, and they're
Oh,
very
nice.
lovable and sweet. So I don't know. But yeah, there's this weird intersection, and even I am the way though too about like we have bears in Ohio, not very many of them. So I've never seen one in real life or anything, but I remember wanting to go to one of the national parks, and the person I was talking to about like planning it was like, "Well, there's bears there." And I'm like, "Oh, maybe I shouldn't go hiking there. Maybe I should stay away. I don't want to get there."
Yeah, totally. They're scary creatures.
Yeah, they're giant.
I always ask people. I remember I was hiking once in a couple of years ago in Colorado in the Flatirons there, and a friend of mine, she lives there, took me on a hike and mentioned, you know, if I wanted to go the next day, I can take this alternative kind of trail, but just to be sure that I took a whistle with me to scare the bears away. And I was like, what? And she told me what to look out for fresh kind of evidence of bears. And the idea petrified me, but you know, when I'm petrified of something, I usually just kind of jump into it and kind of want to explore. Even though this is kind of a creature that could maul me to death, I wanted to kind of see one, but just from a distance. I didn't see any bears, though. But they're, I have actually seen bears in the wild. Maybe it was in Canada years and years back on my first trip to North America, but. Yeah, and I was inside a car, so never while I've been hiking in the US, so have I seen a bear, which is kind of probably a good thing. Yeah, so today is Wednesday. It's Tuesday for you, right? Tuesday night.
Yeah,
Yeah.
you're in the future.
Yeah. And it's not sunny. I'd like to say it's sunny. It's not sunny in the future. Not today, anyway.
Oh my goodness. So, what was I going to say? Oh, let us talk about a little bit about your teaching. And have you done other? So you did the Ashtanga for your 200-hour training, essentially.
That's right.
And have you done other significant trainings, like you have with Tiffany, that you've committed to such a kind of extensive program?
Not really. As most of us do, I kind of continue my education in some form or another, but I haven't really done any other formal teacher training. So I've done my 200-hour just recently, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, maybe four. David Swenson was in my city, well, in the southwest again, down near that Margaret River wine region again, and he was doing I think it was a 60-hour teacher training for the Ashtanga primary series. So I've taken that, and
What
now
was
I've
that like, meeting him and everything?
that was great. He is so good. I hadn't heard anyone say anything bad about him, and I know why.
Ah, awesome.
His energy is amazing. There were maybe 30 people in the training, and he asked everybody at the start to kind of introduce themselves and mention a little bit about themselves and why they were there. And after that first introduction, he'd pick somebody out in the crowd by name, and for the whole 30 people would then be referring to everybody by name. So he's attentive, he's alert, he remembers names, which is kind of difficult, I find.
Oh,
Um,
yeah.
but the you know he had so many good stories about the times that when he and his brother and Nancy Gilgoff, I think a few of the others, Tim Miller, started their practice in Mysore in India with Patabi Joyce. So he had so many good stories about Guruji, and it's kind of rare to be so close to, for me, for the Ashtanga method, so close to the source of Ashtanga.
Oh,
Um,
yeah.
so his stories were so great, and funny. He's so funny. He just would replicate Guruji's accent and the mannerisms of Indian people. He was so good and so respectful of his teacher and the practice itself. That was a phenomenal experience practicing with David, and it was over a week in a beautiful
That's
part of the world again.
incredible.
Yeah, so that
Yeah.
was a great training. And then, yeah, now I'm kind of spending time taking modules, as you are, with Tiffany Cruikshank,
Yeah.
towards my 500-hour teaching. But it's not necessarily that I'm, I guess, seeking to gain any other accreditation. It's more that I just love what Tiffany delivers and her focus on anatomy and how to translate that to helping people through, again, what we love doing through our yoga practice. So
Yeah.
helping people with not just chronic but also acute kind of pain and injuries to help them kind of rehabilitate, I guess, that injury through the practice of yoga.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. I'm still in awe that the Ashtanga manual that we had for my 200 hour was his book.
Oh,
So,
David Swenson's. Oh, wow, really? I was the same. I had his book for many years, and that was like my Bible. It's the one that it's got the primary and the second series in it. That's the one. I think it's his only book, maybe. And for me, that was a manual for me for many years, while I was learning. Well, I think it was more from when I was going from primary to second series of Ashtanga and just to kind of understand it. I had many books on it, and his was I think it was the most simplest. It put it in the simplest way, and it's very easy to understand. He's phenomenal. I'd love to take more from him if you get a chance, and if he's kind of close by. I'm not even sure where he lives. I think he might live in Texas, but if he's close by, yeah, he's so good to train with, to practice with,
Oh,
to
that's
learn from.
awesome. Yeah, I bet. It's just, I found Ashtanga in a time when I really needed something that was really structured and you know, a bit more rigid, and it was helpful for me in lots of ways. So I don't like to knock, you know, the power style of yoga, but I've always also, though, thought of Ashtanga as something sort of separate, because there is so much more emphasis. There isn't an emphasis necessarily on going and getting sweaty, like I feel like there is with Baptiste style or Bikram. So I think that that's one of the things that always stuck with me about Ashtanga was this whole, you know, from the way that it was always presented to me, and even reading Pattabhi Joyce's book, it's so much more about learning how to link your movement and your breath, and really feeling the poses, you know, and being really present in the poses.
Totally, you know, and it's you know, it's the only method that, the only method that I practice now, aside from taking trainings and practicing vinyasa through that period. And the trainings that we take generally last a week, so we practice vinyasa then. But I always miss my Ashtanga practice. So the minute I can, I jump straight back into Ashtanga, which turns into a struggle all over again. It's like starting all over again, even just after a week of not taking it. But, you know, my teaching is only in the vinyasa method, which is kind of interesting. My practice being Ashtanga, but the fact that it's not a popular method so much anymore, I'm not sure why that is. I've been trying to work that out. I've tried taking Ashtanga classes in vinyasa schools, and people just don't like it. They believe it's too strong, or maybe it's the repetition. It's the same poses every day in the same order. But that, to me, is what the beauty behind the practice. You know, you can get completely lost in it, and your mind just switches off, and this flow is just stunning. It's this repetitive movement, and which you get lost in, you know, and that to me is the practice of yoga, switching off and taking that time on your own on the mat for 1, 2, 3, however many hours you practice for, you know. So it's I don't get me wrong, I love the vinyasa and the power methods, and I love to teach it because of the creativity behind it. But yeah, for me, you're right. Ashtanga is something separate, and it kind of almost works out quite well for me, so that it's my practice is something, and then teaching is something, you know. So my practice stays my own kind of exploration, really, I guess. And then, you know, my vinyasa style is to teach what I learn, as for all of us, on our own mat. So I teach very closely to that Ashtanga method, but yeah, with more of the vinyasa kind of flow and creativity of sequencing involved as well.
Yeah, I had to sort of break away from that. The first studio that I taught at was the one that I did my 200 hour, and so it was very much, you know, this is how you structure a class, and these are the poses that you do, and this is the order you do them in. And we didn't necessarily follow the primary series because they were shorter classes. I mean, sometimes it was a half-hour class or 45-minute class, so obviously you can only get so much in. But I still, even to this day, it's very rare that I don't start. I haven't been one of those teachers that really warmed people up. Like, to me, that's what the sun salutations at the beginning are for, is to warm yourself up. So it's very rare for me not to have people starting in Tadasana and moving through a couple sunnays as the way to warm up your body. And it was really hard for me. Like, when I first started teaching at other studios, the first thing I did was created an Ashtanga fusion class that was 75 minutes that would explore parts of the primary series so that people were getting samples of the different poses that made it up, so that they could learn more about Ashtanga and feel like, have like a relationship with it, even though it might not be one that's of depth, that they could explore that on their own. So we would, you know, do the invocation and structured it the same, and I would sample a couple of poses throughout and, you know, whatever, and we would end with the invocation. But when I left that studio, I challenged myself to not start my classes off the same way, and to try something new. So it was definitely difficult. And I still, to this day, I've talked to people who practice a lot of yoga, and some people agree with me and some people don't. But I think that there is very little in this world that, you know, three sun A's and two sun B's can't solve. Like, I really think that, you know, if that's all you have time for, to fit those five sun salutations in, mentally, emotionally, physically, there isn't a whole lot that that sun salutation can't fix. You know, it's just, I really feel like it's the best.
And Pratabi just said, you know, if you have no time for practice, just take three sun A's, three sun B's, and the final three bound lotus poses of the Ashtanga method. And that would be like a, you know, 5 or 10 minute practice, you know, maybe more like 10 minutes. Yeah, but you're right. It, just simply that, he said, is a complete practice. It's working on taking time out, I guess. Like, there's a lot of focus now on mindfulness and meditation. It's that time out for yourself to, you know, flip the reset switch in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I also always liked his kind of acknowledgement of, you know, I've always believed that adversity is what helps us grow. And the people who have gone through a lot of adversity generally have kind of a more depth of character and a little bit deeper understanding sometimes of the world, regardless of their age. And one of the things that I always liked about his approach to yoga was this idea of the duality of things, and to have, you know, he would talk about it a lot in the physical sense and even emotionally, wanting to kind of get away, like when you would be stuck in a pose or you would be feeling trapped or not able to move forward, you know, to stay longer and to deal with what that feels like and to not necessarily run away from that. And also this acknowledgement of the physical pain you're experiencing is letting you know that your body's growing and changing, because you're doing this practice every single day and you can feel the changes happening in your body. And I always would find myself, like when I would have people in poses that were uncomfortable or were more challenging, always reminding them, you know, like, you, to really appreciate the sweetness of life, you have to experience the stuff that's bad, and you have to sit through that, you know, place where it might be uncomfortable. And so I always really liked that idea that I felt like he brought through his teachings of this idea of living and dealing with the discomfort, and that there was another side, and that you, to get to that other side, you have to break kind of down the barriers and to get to that other place.
Completely. My and I'm not sure if I agree with this philosophy or not, and my teacher is, you know, very Ashtanga, only teaches Ashtanga, only practices Ashtanga, but he says sometimes the practice needs to break you, but it will always fix you again. So I'm not quite sure, you know, if I agree with breaking people, but, you know, it's more about kind of what you just mentioned there, you know, working through these difficulties. And, you know, our practice, I think, is there as a sign of, or a tool for us to understand how, you know, how do we respond to that difficult pose on the mat? Do we get frustrated or angry? Or do we just kind of go with it, as you mentioned? Do we just, you know, like, try to relax with it somehow? And similarly, in difficult situations on off the mat, do we resist, or do we kind of try to, like the Buddhist philosophy, flow with it as best as we can? It's that's our yoga practice. That's what it teaches us, I guess, off the mat, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. And I do think, I will say this, I agree with what you're saying, because I don't believe, and that's one thing that I love about Tiffany's teaching, is that she gave me a new way to teach. And I do think that for yoga, you know, I shouldn't be so absolute, but I think the right way to teach yoga is to make the poses fit the person that's practicing.
Yeah, totally.
But in Ashtanga, you're right, that's not how it works. You have to fit the pose the way that it's supposed to be done.
Yeah. So you will get in it now. I'm going to put you in it. You're not ready
exactly.
For it. Here it comes, yeah.
Yeah. I took a workshop, and I'm going to get right back to what I was saying, but I took a workshop with a guy who was Pakistani, and he was a dancer, so he had an amazing, amazing body in terms of his strength and his flexibility and his endurance, because he'd been dancing forever. He also was an Ashtanga teacher, and I went to, like, immersion with him. It was like 2 days. And I remember him like forcing me into the poses. And I did achieve stuff. It was very hot in the room too, and we were obviously very warmed up. But I did achieve poses that I had never, ever had done in my life. But
yeah.
There was one time where I've never particularly cared for a shoulder stand or plow. I have a weird thing about my neck, and I'm also really busty, so as soon as I go upside down, if I'm like bent forward, it's all in my face. So it's always been hard for me to feel comfortable there. And he was like, "No, you're doing it." And I'm like, "No, I don't want to."
It's not right for me.
It's not right for me. And he looked at me and he was like, "That is just your fear, and you are not your fear. You are light, and you are perfection, and you will do this." And I'm like, okay.
Yeah, see, that's such a nice way to put it. You put it in a really nice way, but still, it's like, you will do it.
Yeah, there was like, no, you don't have an option here. You're doing this.
Yeah,
and I was like, okay. But it was a really, it was awesome, though, to also experience that, because I hadn't had really that strict of teachers, you know, so it was nice to see that side of it too. But that's what I appreciate most, I think, about Tiffany's training, is this idea of really being able to make yoga accessible for people so that everyone can do it and everyone feels comfortable and everyone wants to be a part of it, instead of just people who are naturally inclined to be good at it.
Yeah, completely. I mean, she has such a good way of delivering her content and of educating, to make it an accessible practice. That's what it is. That's what it should be. It's a practice for everybody to do. And, you know, the practice can be just sitting, right, with our meditation. We don't even need to move. So that's yoga, sitting on your mat and working the breath and tuning into the rhythm of your breath. Yoga is for everybody. My teacher always used to say to me as well, when I was injured, which happened a lot throughout the years, he would still not let me miss a day on my mat. He'd say, "Come to the studio and you sit on your mat and you practice yoga." So he wouldn't let me miss a day, and I every day I thank him for that, you know, strictness, you know, the discipline that he taught me, you know. He taught me so much. I don't think, I keep telling him, like, I keep mentioning it to him. I mean, my practice now is mostly on my own. I don't have time to, I can't kind of slot in my practice at my regular Mysore style time early in the morning anymore, because I'm often teaching either late at night or first thing in the morning. So mostly my practice is on my own, and sometimes I'll practice with my teacher, which is awesome. I regularly give him my thanks, you know, because he's the one that kind of, showed me that dedication and that the focus really kind of, it pushes you past, you know, even, you know, that idea of breaking to fix you. It pushes you past certain barriers and certain boundaries that we don't even know are there. And then you get to the other side and you're like, "My God, what is going on? This thing that I'm doing, this yoga, is phenomenal." And it keeps getting better and better, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's what I, and maybe it's just because that was really the first style that I learned and I really took time to immerse in, but I think that's one of the beautiful things about Ashtanga, is that it can be, there's just so many facets of it, and while it can be very unforgiving, it also can be this place of, you know, self-realization. And, you know, I think some people, like, I definitely came to Ashtanga broken, not necessarily physically, but definitely from an emotional standpoint. You know, I don't, I felt Ashtanga is what made me whole again, you know, like that was what, it was something I was already broken, you know, emotionally I felt broken, and I came there and I got a little bit more broken.
I can imagine.
I got a little bit more of the areas kind of cleaned out and pushed away, and I had to learn not just how to have flexibility of my body, but how to be flexible mentally and how to have a flexible spirit, and to be okay with things in life, and to know that this is just my path and that it's all right. And so for me, it's always been something that I've really loved, and although I'm not as dedicated as I used to be to it, it's the foundation from which my practice and my teaching has grown. So
Yeah.
For me, it holds like a special place in my heart. There's a lot of people who don't particularly care for it, and I know there's a lot of I don't notice it as much here in my community, but I know in Europe, especially in the UK, there's a very specific hierarchy and ways of doing things there. But I have had a little bit of backlash when I was doing the Ashtanga Fusion class. I did get a little bit of pushback and like questions from other Ashtangis in the community. Who did you train with? You know, where did your training come from? Things like that.
Right.
But so I understand when people talk about like elitism from it, but I also think that it does draw a specific type of personality.
Completely, yeah.
So that's what you're going to find with that, you know, and that's okay.
You know, talking about that hierarchy is interesting because David Swenson even mentioned it. Somebody raised, you know, a question about, do you think it's necessary for us to practice in Mysore in India with Sharath now? And he said, well, if you want to go to Mysore, India, go to Mysore in India. He said, it's the same practice. He said, people have this idea now of having to be accredited, you know, like these people that were questioning you with your Yoga Fusion class. It's like they have this idea that you need an accreditation or you need an accredited teacher to have trained with. But David said, but I'm not accredited and I've never been accredited. So he's like, so what is accreditation anyway? So,
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So, I know it exists, but that hierarchy that you mentioned, all that kind of questioning of your knowledge, but you know, I mean, yoga is yoga, whatever the practice is, you know, so long as we're practicing it, it doesn't matter who or where it comes from. If we're sharing it, I think it's a great thing.
Yeah, I agree with you. And we had a discussion once at like a staff meeting at a studio. Somebody brought up this idea of who should be teaching. And this person was a newer teacher, and so I think that they were just kind of at that place in their journey and learning and growing. And who should be teaching the power classes? Who should be teaching the classes, the level 3 classes with inversions? Do you have to – basically, she wanted a coveted spot and was trying to, like, say that the person who was teaching it wasn't as good at yoga as she was. And so she should be teaching the class. And I remember seeing, like – a good teacher doesn't have to do the pose. Like that's a good teacher knows how the body works and knows how to cue properly to help their students do the pose. We don't have to do it. Like it's not about us showing off. It's not about us saying, look, I can do, you know, headstand or handstand or whatever it is that you want people to be doing. That's not what makes a good teacher. So just because you can do the poses doesn't mean you can teach the poses. And
completely.
So I think, but that's what I like, though, about Ashtanga. While it's very rigid and it is very much about you have to do the poses a certain way, it also is about your journey. It's not about, like, where the other person on the mat next to you is in the primary series. It's about where you are.
Yeah.
And that's where the emphasis is.
And you're so caught up with what is going on your own mat.
Yeah,
you know, you're like, what? You want me to do what now? Where is my hand meant to be? You know, like, you're so caught up with that, you know, sometimes there's a little bit of solidarity that you know, I find in a Mysore style where you get pushed into something that you didn't know you're capable of and you come out completely depleted and almost collapse in a mess on the mat. And the person beside you can just feel this invisible pat on your back. Like, just, I hear you. Yeah. But, yeah, it is a self-exploration. And, you know, I love it as well. I mean, Socrates was, I think it was Socrates that said, you know, a life without self-examination is not a life worth living, I think. That's what he said. I don't quote me. But basically it is that, I mean, and that's all yoga. It's self-exploration, isn't it? We're just kind of exploring on our mat. So, I think it's all the same. But, yeah, the Ashtanga method does have a special place in my heart anyway. And yours too.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's a great introduction. I wanted to also talk about sort of the uniqueness of male teachers. There's not as many. I know, obviously, there's more people in the United States, so obviously per capita, we probably have more male teachers than you do in Australia, but that's just because of numbers. But proportionally, it's probably the same if you looked at it from that standpoint.
Yeah, I see, yeah.
So what do you think, I mean, your experience is going to be very different than my experience. And I remember when we were in Arizona, for example, you were the only male teacher in the room with
us
that day.
Yeah, yeah. That's interesting to me as well. Like, I was really surprised at that training that I was the only male there. It used to be a practice where, when I first started, as I mentioned at the start of our chat, in that old church hall space, it was, I'm pretty sure I was the only male back then with maybe 7 to 10 older ladies in the room. Similarly with Iyengar, I was one of few males. So, but when I moved to Ashtanga for the second time, when I stuck with it, it was interesting that was more of a split between men and women. It was more balanced. There did seem to be a lot more males practicing that form, and by the accounts I've heard, the method was developed. The Ashtanga method was developed for young boys in India to prepare them for going into the army. So it was developed for with males in mind. It's fascinating now. Like, it is something that more women practice. That's obvious in classes. I mean, more often than not, I'm teaching classes which are just women, and there might be one or two men in there, but a lot of times it's just women in the class. To me, it makes no difference whether there's women or men. I'd love for more men to invest in the practice because I know what it gives us, and how it provides for us. I can't explain why, but I don't know. It is maybe it's more confronting for men, for that turning inwards, that connection to our emotions and to our responses. Masculinity kind of can drive, society can drive you away from that to conform and to fit in. I've never been one that fits in, though, or that conforms. But society can push you towards a more kind of, maybe, I don't know, this is just how I see it, I guess, more towards a more, that space where you switch off from your emotions, I guess, where you aren't connected to them. So perhaps it's because of that men shy away from it. I met yesterday at the studio an Irish guy, I love it when these kind of really masculine guys kind of invest in yoga, and he was new to it, and he was explaining to me how much he loved it, and I was just kind of like, this is so awesome. Like, why aren't more guys kind of connected to it like you are? Not that I mentioned it to him, but I just love it when I see guys kind of get it, like they get the power of it. But yeah, so it is, yeah, it is, it is a lot, classes are, more and more full of women, but it doesn't take away from the practice. I just wish more that men would experience it as women experience it too.
Yeah, I agree. I think that there's definitely, similar things that gender-based that you get from it. But I also do think that it gives men a space where they're allowed to be contemplative and they're allowed to go within and be silent, and there aren't expectations. Like, there aren't, at least in a studio that has a healthy environment, there aren't gender-based expectations for people inside the classrooms, like, it's everyone's equal on their mats, and there isn't any expectation that you'll behave differently on your mat than I will because you're a man and I'm a woman. Like, there doesn't exist there. I also think that men physically get benefits that are very different than women. Like, I find, you know, women, generally speaking, are hyperflexible or are more flexible in their joints, especially in their spine and their pelvis. And men tend to be the opposite of that. And so I think that, you know, from an anatomical standpoint, the benefits, I think, for men are almost more beneficial than they are for women in doing yoga, because they are so stiff and rigid and need things to help them make space. And, you know, from a female standpoint, whether, you know, you choose to have children or not, like, our bodies are designed in a way to make space inside them. Like, that's how they're designed, is to be this flexible kind of malleable thing that can shift and change to make space to grow a baby inside of us. Men don't have that. And so fundamentally their bodies are very fixed and stay kind of the way they are their whole lives, you know, through the aging process. So I think that it's very beneficial. And I think that that's kind of where I try to go with it with guys too, is this idea of, hey, you know, you complain about having low back pain, or you complain about your hamstrings being really tight. Yoga can help that. Like, yoga can make you feel better.
Completely.
You know?
I guess, and, you know, with me and my exploration of yoga, I mean, there's many times, I'm sure you've heard it as well, where people say, well, I'm not flexible enough to do yoga, you know? And that's kind of, you know, that's switching off, that's closing a big heavy door, you know. we all know that it's not about, those of us that do practice yoga know that it isn't about the flexibility. And for me, I was never a rigid kind of, I used to do a lot of athletics. I used to run and high jump and long jump. So I was always active with my body, but I never considered myself flexible. I was more flexible than the general guy of my same age. But, you know, once I started the yoga, and particularly Ashtanga yoga, I realized how rigid my body was. And then eventually, and, you know, you're talking about women are made to be kind of more malleable, more flexible. I think you're completely right. Like, my body, I found, was very rigid and tight. But then I discovered this power in my body, this strength, which to me is something that I work now on balancing. I've always tried more with my flexibility side, because that's the more struggle for me. The strength component of the practice, it still is a struggle, don't get me wrong, but comes easier than the flexibility for me. So that, I think, is, you know, that male-female thing as well, you know, like the males in yoga practice find the strength component easier, where women, I think, maybe find the flexibility easier. And that's not in general, you know, there's some men who move are way more flexible than women, and vice versa. There's a lot of women that are stronger than men, you know, through practice. But I think in a general sense, that's kind of like how the different sexes experience yoga, that strength versus flexibility, that yin and yang, it's male-female, right? It's that balance that we need in life. It's very interesting.
Yeah, for sure. So one of the things I always ask everyone too is, if you had any recommendations for somebody who wants to start practicing, or is new to yoga, or is interested in it, you can give like top three or top five or whatever it is, you know, advice that you have for somebody brand new who's never done it.
Sure. Well, I think no expectations is something. Don't expect anything from it. It's again, it's that idea of non-attachment to our practice. We don't seek a pose, or we don't seek anything from the practice. We just practice for the sake of practice. So, don't have any expectations on what it can deliver. Just take what it does give you, because it will give you a lot, but don't expect it. Patience is a big thing as well, I think. Being able to, you know, we've spoke a lot about blockages and hitting barriers through our practice, and that will occur again and again. And there's been many times where I've questioned why why am I doing this? Why do I continue? Like, what's the point of all this? But I think, again, being patient with the practice will lead you somewhere which, I don't know, for me, I never imagined the benefits that I received from this practice. So just being patient with the practice and persistent with the practice, I think, is important. And also, yeah, that is dedication. So I guess it's top three. No expectations, patience, and a dedication. Without question, again, just get on your mat. And particularly at those times where you don't want to, I think there are, I mean, I have a daily practice now, and almost every day the excuses come up in my head. But maybe you want to read your book, but maybe you've got to research this article, but maybe you just need a rest, or your body's sore, your knee hurts, you know. And there'll be all sorts of excuses, particularly at those times. Just get on your mat and start to move, you know. And even like you say, if it's just those three sun salutes, or even if it's sitting on your mat for 5 minutes for a meditation, you know, just that it doesn't have to be a 30, 60, 90, 120 minute practice, you know. It can just be a couple of minutes on your mat where you're taking that time to reset, to flick that switch again. So yeah, dedication to the practice, particularly where you feel it's most challenging to get on your mat, just place yourself there.
Yeah, for sure.
And yeah, and
great.
It's not about what we do on our mat. It's just about bringing ourselves to it. So making sure you take that time, set that time for yourself for the practice of yoga.
That's awesome. I think that's really great advice for people. Before we go, I just wanted to talk a little bit about your traveling. You travel a lot. And I'm not a great traveler. I was talking, I'm not sure if I had this on record last time or not, but I love the idea of traveling. Like, I think that traveling is great, and I'm super gung-ho about people should get out there and see new things and experience new things and all that jazz. And if I could, like, teleport home every night, I would be traveling all the time. But that's not the case, right? So I'm not very good at traveling, and that's something that I'm working on. And you would think, as a yoga teacher, that I'd be a lot more flexible, but I am somebody who's really comforted by my routines. I think a lot of it has to do with I just have a lot of anxiety issues,
right.
And so routines for me are very nice and helpful.
Right.
And even when I do have, like, even when I am traveling, not that I need to be pointing out my idiosyncrasies, but like even at Tiffany's trainings, I will almost have the exact same thing for breakfast if it's available to me every single day.
Right.
And that's just part of me having a routine. So now I'm in a new place, and I will have exactly the same thing every single day. If it's like,
right.
So when people were complaining in Arizona last year or in California last year about having the same thing for breakfast, I was like, what are you talking about? This is amazing. I love it.
Right.
I'm glad we're having the same thing.
This is the Ashtangi in you.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, I am fine with it. I love having the same thing for breakfast every day.
Yeah.
But I do think that, you know, I wish that I could be better at traveling. And so, you know, maybe even not necessarily talking about all the places you've been, but what encourages you to go and to try these new things and to go to new places? And I feel like you sort of fearlessly explore the whole globe, and it's, you know, it's really impressive.
Yeah, it's interesting. And, you know, you're saying that you have a lot of anxieties, and I'm the same, you know, and that's part of the reason that, you know, I work with yoga as well, just to keep all that at bay too. But, you know, traveling gives me complete fear and complete anxiety, and I'm a mess the day before I take a trip anywhere, even, you know, if it's to within my country, not so far away. More so when I travel internationally, I get this big panic and this big fear in me. And, you know, that's part of, you know, I think I mentioned before that when something scares me, I confront it. I push myself to do it and to explore it. And I think that's part of travel for me as well. Aside from the fact that when I'm there, you know, when I get to the place that I'm heading to, I love it. And I, more often than not. I love it. I love exploring different foods, different people, different cultures, different routines, different traditions, different environments, different climates, different currencies. I love exploring it all, you know. It's just, this is, and you know, then I'm somewhere, I was just recently in Tokyo, and I was just, I think it was the day we were leaving, our flight was, this is just a couple of weeks back, our flight was at midnight, so we had all day in Tokyo to explore, and to me it just didn't make sense that all this action, all this activity on the ground was still occurring while I, you know, when I was to get back to my city, little city on the other side of the world in Perth in Western Australia. How is it that this kind of, you know, our spaces just and our environments and people riding bikes along the streets on the other side of the world, how does that still continue when, you know, we don't see it, we're not aware of it? I love being in foreign places. I just don't like the process of getting there. I'm actually heading to the United States again on Sunday, heading to Los Angeles to start with. I'm taking my mum, who's never been to the States before, my mum, my aunt and uncle, so this will be a big test for me with patience. And they're all in their 70s, you know, but just the idea of that transportation to the other side of the world for me, getting on planes and being in airports, is, it's very uncomfortable. I'm also very tall, so and I'm sitting coach, so it's not the most comfortable of processes. But once I'm there, and, you know, I love your country. I it's my second time there this year. I usually travel there once or twice a year at least to the US. I love the people there. I have so many good friends, and mostly through yoga now, the people that I know in your country I've met through yoga, and that's another thing about yoga, you meet so many amazing people. But but yeah, it's the exploration and, you know, just this fascination with how all these different pockets of people can exist simultaneously around the world doing these random things upside down, you know, for us in Australia, or, you know, right side up in China. But yeah, it just, it completely fascinates me. It charges me as well. It stimulates me, and it also, when I'm there, it relaxes me, you know, to not have the pressures that we experience in our own life, in our own environments, when you remove yourself from it and you place yourself somewhere foreign where you may know one or two people, but you don't have a lot of pressures to do or be anywhere or, you know, move anything, or, you know, you just have to be there. And that's, I think, why I like travel so much, and why I travel so much. It's just an escape from realities, even though our reality can be relaxed and involve a lot of yoga in our home environment, and still our home environment where there's still a lot of pressures. It just removes that, I think, when you're somewhere foreign, somewhere overseas, somewhere international, or even somewhere outside of your city and your own country too.
That's awesome. Thank you for sharing that. I would never have guessed that you ever are, like, anxious and stressed out.
Oh, my God. So. A lot of people say that. I think I just hide it well now. I think that's my yoga as well. It just kind of, I just deal with it inside.
I understand that. I mean, people will ask me, especially when there's, like, new people to class or something, and they might ask, why did I start doing yoga? And I'm like, well, because I'm a spaz. that's why I do it. And, you know, so, like, when people talk to me now, if they think I'm being crazy or I'm being a spaz, I'm like, could you imagine if I didn't do yoga every day?
You know, I think we have similar responses. It's like, imagine if I didn't do yoga. I'm this crazy now, or this anxious now. Imagine if I didn't have a practice of yoga. My God. Beware.
Yeah, that's exactly, beware. That's exactly what would happen. Oh, my goodness. Well, thank you so much for being a part of this. I really appreciate it.
It's been great to talk to you, Tracy, as always.
Yeah, and all of Sava's contact information will be in the notes section, obviously, so you can reach out to him. And of course, if you're in Australia ever, stop into a class for him and see what he has to offer. It's there's a way about you that's just very calming, I think, and grounding. And so I can only imagine, you know, what it's like to be in one of your classes, because you just,
oh,
you do.
That's so sweet.
Well, it's true, and I also do think that you have a very nurturing way about you, too. So I'm sure that that comes through when you're teaching. That's the one thing that I don't know, and I've said this to people at the trainings, and they look at me like I'm crazy. I'm like, I would love to have time when we are at our trainings to take classes with each of you.
Right.
To be, even if it's just like a 15-minute thing that you do, being able to experience the other teachers and the way that they teach and the things they say, and I would love to be able to do that, and I wish that we had an opportunity to do that as part. The trainings for me are so helpful to be a better teacher and to learn, but there's also that social component of it in getting to talk to the other teachers and be with the other teachers, and that is just as valuable.
And I guess to hear what they're doing, you know, like... You know, like yourself, you know, I love to talk to people, and I'm always so inspired by what everybody is doing. I'm just kind of like, oh, my God, I need to do more. But yeah, you're right. That social part and that connection with like-minded people who are working with yoga to do some fascinating things and really encouraging motivational things with the practice and inspiring things. You know, it's so good to connect in these trainings with similar like-minded people who are just about exploring and sharing this great tool, this great practice.
Yeah, for sure. So keep, you know, posting your pictures, though, of your travels, because it
makes
me feel like I can live vicariously through you.
I've actually had a social media cleanse this week. I haven't kind of connected, but I'll be back once I start traveling, I'm sure.
Oh, good, good. I like seeing all the pictures. They're just beautiful. You always post very nice things. So, but yes, thank you again for being with us.
Thanks again, Tracy. Yeah, and hope to see you soon.
Yeah, for sure. And thank you to the listeners for being there. Again, you know, if you want to reach out, do so. We love to hear comments and opinions from students. And if you have any questions, too, especially you guys out there who might be feeling weird about going to a yoga studio, you know, he's the perfect person to ask your questions, too, and he'll give you some really solid advice. So we will be back again soon. Thank you.